spirit of your life.
Okay, so
should I start?
Yeah. So basically, you're going to hand in the homework today, and you are now struggling with these equations to a certain extent in characterizing damped electromagnetic waves that are propagating in lossy media. And you either are going to use one of the two middle rows of these equations, or you're going to go back to the exact equations. These are simplified equations, and they hold when sigma over omega epsilon is either much less than 1 or much greater than 1. And the typical question that students ask at this point, what do you mean by much greater and much less? And the rule of thumb is, if it is factor of 10, if something is bigger than by a factor of 10, that can be interpreted as much, much. And if it is something, again, smaller than unity by a factor of 10, 0.1 or less, you can assume that's much, much less. Okay? And as long as that is true, factor of 10 is involved or in a larger factor, these equations give very accurate results. But if it's not, the contrast isn't that big. I see that contrast is over there to be away from me. Okay, that's okay. And you know, if it is not that, the contrast is not all that large, then these equations are not going to give such good results. And then what do? You go and use the actual equations, okay? And in the last problem, part B, the occasion arises that you should actually use the actual equation, not these simplified versions, but the real equations from which these simplified versions came, and those are these equations, okay, written in two different ways. Alright, so the red version is what I had on blackboard. They are equivalent. If you push j omega inside the first square root, you will see that it becomes exactly that. So j omega goes inside being squared, and one of them accompanies mu, the other goes and changes the bracket. Alright, so you can always, you know, you can calculate this as on your calculator. Gamma is a number, eta is a number, and you do whatever you like with it, okay? They are both going to be complex number. The gamma is going to be a complex number with a real part and an imaginary part. You will take and call its real part alpha. That is the numerical value of alpha, and alpha is the attenuation constant, and beta is the propagation constant or wave number, and it's just 2 pi inverted. It gives you the wavelength, or you go omega over beta, that gives you the velocity. You will find that velocity is going to be frequency dependent if you calculate the betas at different frequencies, because this is a more complicated equation. All right? Now, going back to the final discussion we had of the good conductor case, good conductor when its sigma is much, much greater than omega epsilon, or the sigma over omega epsilon ratio in magnitude is much greater than 1, then the beautiful result that you can remember is that alpha and beta turn out to be exactly the same thing, approximately. Square root of pi f mu sigma, as I mentioned. Okay? And what happens to the intrinsic impedance in the same case? Let's go back to the master equation. In the master equation, if sigma is the dominant guy, and then you forget about epsilon, then obviously j omega comes upstairs, leaving me j omega mu divided by sigma, and the magnitude of that is going to be simply square root of mu over mu omega divided by sigma. And what about the angle? What about the angle? Well, it's the angle of the square root of j. What is the square root of j? What kind of an angle does it have? J has an angle of 90 degrees, therefore square root of J has an angle, Akash knows this very well by now, is 45 degrees, right? And that is why, when you go to the table, that's what you see. All right? So here you see the magnitude and the angle associated. So what happens is that in a good conductor, the E and H waveforms are 45 degrees out of phase. Okay? Now, imperfect dielectric, there is also a phase shift, but it's a tiny, tiny fraction, okay? It is of the order of sigma over omega epsilon, and sigma over omega epsilon is tiny in the imperfect conductor case. But in any case, in a case that doesn't belong to either of these categories, you go ahead and calculate the complex number eta using the formula, and then using your calculator, you turn that complex number and put it in the exponential form and pay attention to its magnitude and its angle. There's going to be some angle that is involved, something less than 45 all the way down to zero is going to be a phase shift that we'll be working with. All right, so these are the various aspects of the problems that you'll be solving. Now, last lecture we pointed out that if we look at the attenuation constant and then take its inverse, which is our penetration depth, we find that it is incredibly small number for, let's say, copper, okay? And then what we pointed out that it's also incredibly small number when we use the imperfect dielectric equation for propagation in seawater. It's on the order of centimeters or something like that. That is terrible if you want to communicate between two submarines. But it turns out that if you change your frequency, okay, if you lower your frequency of operation so that eventually for seawater this thing becomes greater than one, okay, then you are in this regime and you should be paying attention to this equation. What's significant about that equation is that attenuation constant is proportional to the square root of F. That means that if F goes lower and lower and lower again, okay, you can make F low enough that this attenuation constant is small enough that when you invert it, that penetration depth is large enough so that you can perhaps communicate. Okay? So one of the homework problems that you are doing says, you know, what should be the frequency or what should be the distance so that the power that is transmitted from one submarine to another submarine has been attenuated to only 0.1%. Okay, 0.1% is a lot of loss, but it's still something that can be useful enough. Okay, and anyway, so you're going to answer that question. The trick then is for submarine communication is to go to real low frequencies, about a kilohertz or even less. Of course, that is problematic. Okay, with very low frequencies, you have very low bandwidth. You can, the amount of information that you can pass is slow. Right, you don't have much of a bandwidth. But you know, then these military guys who run these submarines tend to talk in brief little codes. Right? Anyway, so they somehow manage. Any questions? So, is there anything else I really want to talk about this subject? There is one homework problem I want to comment on. So I have a lot of examples, and I don't want to go through them. Okay. Unless there are questions, okay? In some of these, we are calculating the pointing flux. And the pointing flux is going down, of course. So let me answer your question, Alex, now. When I have the E cross H star, which I'm going to then take the real part and divide by 2, okay? E to the minus alpha C that is coming both from E and H are multiplying one another, and they become E to the minus alpha 2x or 2z, all right? The complex exponential e to the plus or minus beta j's that you have, because of conjugation, when they touch one another, they disappear, okay? So that e to the minus 2 alpha z comes out, and it makes sure that for any wave that is propagating in either direction, you are going to find reduced power downstream. Downstream means away from the source. Upstream means towards the source, right? Thinking of rivers. So you're always going to find smaller pointing flux downstream rather than upstream. And in one of the homework problems, you have a question, say, consider a cube of volume. How much power is being dissipated in this volume is the question, okay? And some students who came to my office hours says, oh, it looks like we have to do a joule heating calculation, J dot E, it gives you that. And probably we have to do J dot E, and then we have to integrate it over a volume. Of course, you can do the problem that way, but that is too much work. It is easier to look at the pointing flux. So you have a cube, okay? What is significant is one, there are two phases. One is the entry phase, one is the exit phase, okay? You calculate S here, and you calculate S there. If the medium was lossless, then the time average S's on those two phases would be exactly identical. And you would say all the power that is entering this volume is also exiting it. There is no, nothing is being dissipated there, okay? In this case, because of S being proportional to e to the minus 2 alpha z, you are going to calculate bigger S magnitude here than bigger than the S magnitude there, okay? So then there is more power coming in than exiting, okay? So suppose that after you work them out, Alex, one is, you know, 10, the other is 2 or something like that. What do you conclude? Well, 8 is being lost inside. That's, you know, that's the amount of power that's being lost. Where is it going? It's going into heat. Okay. And so that is the easy problem, okay? So, and that whole thing is possible because of Poynting's theorem, okay? J dot E is a portion of the Poynting's theorem. Poynting flux calculations are a portion of the Poynting's theorem. And they are summing up to something like zero, right? There is a balance of these things. So to calculate one term, you don't have to calculate that term. You can calculate the other term, and the other term will give you the term that you're looking for. This is what we have done a lot in earlier stages of our course. Sometimes we ask you to calculate the flux, but that was nothing other than figuring out how much there was charge in that water. A similar sort of thing. You always do the easier math to do the answer. Any questions here? How many of you are almost finished with the homework? Not so many. But it's today. It's due today. 5 o'clock. Right? All right. So,
Professor?
Yes?
So for that problem, for, we just plug in our z values to our e to the minus 2z portion?
So, F, remind me the problem. Is it this problem?
Yeah. Problem?
So, yeah, please, calculate the Poynting flux right here. Calculate the Poynting flux right there. There are two different numbers. You take their difference, and that's
it. You just plug in your z values for
those. Yeah. For instance, at z equals 0, this gives you 1. Okay. But of course, there was some number in front of it. I forgot what that is, but that's exactly what it is. That's all. And so you don't have to do the j dot e and take some integers. If you do it right, it's going to give you the same thing. Okay. And use a penetration depth for water, seawater, at a given frequency. What frequency? I forgot. It must be here. Yeah, 2 pi times 10 to the 3 at 1 kilohertz. Penetration distance is 8 meters. That's what it is in seawater. 40 meters, you're e to the minus 5 down. That's pretty bad. Okay. So it is easier than sometimes submarines that are just below the surface communicate by having their signals go to the surface and then propagate along the surface and come down and see the next submarine. Okay, that might be a bit better way. There is a lot of refraction when you get out from the seawater to the air, so things bend. There can be a surface mode, and that also penetrates. So those are the sort of details that you learn in higher level courses. There are surface modes, etc. We don't need to go into that right now. The math of it is pretty complicated, actually. But they manage to communicate one way or another. Okay, so what's our next topic? Our next topic is something we have finished, circular polarizations. So we skip that and come to the next topic. And that is this, wave reflection and transmissions. And let me show you a movie. Not a movie. This is one of my animations. If you go to the calendar and click some of those animations, and this is not the calendar, but effectively the same page I maintain on my server at CSL, and I want us to look at this picture, this movie. Boom. Okay, so first we had a cosinusoidally propagating wave, and Elmo, when you said, I don't know what propagation is, this is what propagation is. This was a waveform representing, let's say, electric field propagating. Let me start it from the beginning. There is a source on this side, and there is a wall at z equals 900 meters. Okay? So a cosinusoidal wave will propagate away from this source until it hits the wall. After it hits the wall, there are two different things that are happening. Because those are two different cases. Okay, so let's start again. We start with a purely cosinusoidal propagating wave. Boom, it hits the wall. Now, the wave that hits the wall turns around and propagates backwards as a reflected wave. So for a while, you have a combination of only a portion of the reflected wave going back while the full forward coming wave is there. But after you wait enough, then in this picture, all regions are filled with positive and negative going waves, okay? On the top picture, the reflected wave has exactly the same amplitude as the incident wave, and because of that, what is generated is what we know as a standing wave pattern. We generate a full standing wave pattern. In the second picture, reflection is not complete. Okay? So in the second picture, really, what I imagine is this is a wall, but this wall is the wall of a medium that is also allowing electromagnetic wave propagation. Whereas that wall was a complete mirror. It was a perfect conductor that you cannot penetrate, therefore everything that comes in gets reflected, and you form a full standing wave pattern in the incidence region. While in the second case, this wall is of a material that can also transmit electromagnetic waves, maybe glass or something like that. And some portion of the incident wave goes in, therefore what is reflected back doesn't quite have the same amplitude as the incident wave. So therefore the superposition that you see there is creating a different sort of a pattern. Okay, the one on the bottom is like this. It's a galloping wave. The other one is a standing wave. Okay? And both are associated with so-called standing wave ratios. And we'll learn about standing wave ratios as we go along, in particular when we are studying transmission lines. And let's watch this again. Now pay attention before the standing wave or the galloping wave is generated. Pay attention to that. Now it's over. Now everything has reached some sort of a steady state in the region that we are seeing. So you usually do things in the frequency domain. You usually don't show time domain pictures, but once in a while things like this are important. And when we start studying transmission lines starting tomorrow, one of the things that we'll do at the front end is we're going to do some time domain pictures. We're going to be following what pulses do. There's a little bit of a ping pong game that the pulses will be doing as they bounce in between the source points and the load points, while they travel unimpeded in between through the transmission lines and they interact with the load and the source point. There is going to be things similar to this. Okay? That's going to be on transmission lines. But today we're not going to talk about transmission lines. We're going to talk about reflections and transmissions in inhomogeneous propagation media. Which is this lecture. Okay? So far, what did we do? First, we studied propagation in homogeneous media, lossless. Then, the last 2 days, we talked about propagation in lossy, but still homogeneous media. Now it's time to have sort of a mixed situation, a little bit inhomogeneous. An inhomogeneous setting that is composed of two homogeneous regions side by side. Region 1, for z less than 0, is occupied by some material. Region 2, occupying z greater than 0, a second material. Both materials are homogeneous, but they are not the same. If they are the same, of course, the problem becomes trivial and uninteresting. Okay? We're going to consider in region 1 a wave that is propagating in plus z direction to be incident on this interface between region 1 and region 2, which is, of course, z equals 0 plane. And try to satisfy Maxwell's equation. What happens? We're going to find that what you need is a reflected wave, what you need is a transmitted wave, and there is going to be ratios between the incident wave amplitudes and the transmitted and reflected wave amplitudes, and those ratios will be defined to be reflection coefficient and transmission coefficient. This is what we want to do. And we are only going to do this with normal incidence. In other words, wave is propagating straight into an interface. In EC 350 and 452, etc., you deal with this situation. You come at an angle, oblique propagations and reflections, etc. Okay, of course, that is very important. You may imagine for practical purposes, but this is the beginnings. Okay, you start analyzing stuff with normal incidence, and some of the normal incidence lessons that we will learn here are going to be directly applicable in a transmission line setting. In a transmission line setting, everything is one-dimensional. In a one-dimensional situation, there cannot be oblique reflections. There can only be normal reflections. So therefore, this exercise now is meaningful. It prepares us what we'll be seeing when we study transmission lines. Okay, so now, what is pertinent? What is pertinent is, of course, the boundary conditions. What about boundary conditions? I never had a full lecture on boundary conditions. I tried to integrate bits and pieces of intuition about boundary conditions as we go along, but by this time, hopefully, we are all comfortable with the boundary conditions. Okay? The pertinent equations are summarized over there, just as a reminder. And these are written exactly in the same fashion I once upon a time, maybe long, long time ago, on the blackboard, demonstrated, you take all the dels, replace them with unit vectors, you take all the vectors and replace them by their plus-minus differences, and you get rid of all the time derivative terms, but the source terms of rho and j, volumetric charge and current densities, become now surface charge and surface current density. These are the equations. What do they say? The normal component of D will not jump unless there is a surface charge density. Normal component of B never jumps. Tangential component of E never jumps. Normal component of H will jump if there is a surface current density, but otherwise it's not going to jump. Okay? So right now, we're going to use these boundary conditions with no jumps at all, because I want to look at two media that will not, by definition, have okay, what am I going to do? I'm going to take my first medium, region 1, to be a dielectric, okay? It's going to be a dielectric, and therefore sigma is equal to 0 in that region. I will be a little bit more general, and in the second medium I'll say, okay, it can be a dielectric, but it can be also conducting, there is a conductivity to it, okay? If there is a conductivity, there are some mobile charge carriers, so there's going to be some J, okay? There's going to be a volumetric J, okay? And but there is no necessity for a surface J. Okay, so in that sense, when I am using these equations, I am going to be going from one side to the other side by setting all the normal components and all the tangential components to be zero. After we do that, after we get our results, eventually I will take as one subcategory the limit that sigma 2 goes to infinity. I would say if sigma 2 gets larger and larger all the way to infinity, then it will be the case of a perfect conductor, something that doesn't exist but I can use as an idealization. Okay? When we do that, this is what we're going to find. Second medium being a good conductor, we are going to have actually rapidly damped solutions in the second medium because of what we studied just yesterday and earlier today, okay? In the second medium, the waves will be attenuated with e to the minus alpha z type of variation, and that will have, therefore, a skin effect sort of a thing, okay? So there will be fields and there will be volumetric turns in the second medium, but they will all be close by to the surface that is separating the two regions, okay? When I take the limit as sigma goes to infinity, that skin effect is going to be extreme, okay? The penetration distance is going to go effectively to zero. Okay, what does that mean? What really that means is that in reality there is a very intense volumetric current that is flowing near the surface of this material body, conducting body, but as I'm taking the sigma to infinity, all is piling up towards the surface. So it is only in that limit that I'm going to say I have a surface current, okay? Unless sigma goes to infinity, I don't have to invoke the concept of a surface current. Surface current is another idealization. It is really volumetric current integrated through a very thin skin region and pretended as if it is all flowing in the surface. So that's the picture, okay? So finally, okay, in the limit of a PEC, perfect electric conductor, we will say, well, there is absolutely no field inside, and the jump of the H from outside to the inside is being compensated by this surface current density. In reality, there is no such material. In reality, there is no jump. H is continuous, but there is also that region is conducting, and we can do this fiction to help ourselves. We effectively generate, therefore, the concept of surface current density in this fashion to help ourselves to make these problems easier. And I'm going to have an example problem in which I will take a finite sigma second medium. I will calculate the current density, volumetric current density that is flowing. I will integrate that current density along the distance z. And if I take a volumetric current density and integrate it along z, I reduce the dimensionality of current density from amperes per meter squared to amperes per meter, which is the right unit of the surface current density. And I will find out that integrated current matches exactly our concept of surface current density. We will show that quantitatively. And from there on, you will know exactly what we mean by surface current density later in your life. You will say, well, that's an idealization. That's really doesn't really exist in real life, but it is useful to pretend it does. It simplifies many of our problems.
Okay, so that's an intro, but now let's get to the business. All right, so then I say that if there is an incident wave onto an arbitrary surface like this, but if there were no other fields generated, transmitted field or reflected field, I cannot satisfy boundary conditions. Why is that? Because my E and H are maintaining a certain ratio, okay, and that ratio is called, in magnitude, say it. E to H ratio is? In general, what is the E over H?
Eta,
exactly. Intrinsic impedance, okay? If we have two different materials, the chances are they're going to have different eta, okay? And if I have my first incident wave that is enjoying a certain eta, just enter the second medium without any other thing happening, it would not be maintaining the same eta, and something weird is happening. So either E or H is going to be different on one side of the boundary than the other, therefore forcing me to admit that there is a jump in tangential E or tangential H, which cannot be allowed if we set J sub as equal to zero. So just simply moving in as the incident field, moving into the second medium, is not viable. There has to be a reflected wave. That is why we have set up here the problem in this fashion. I have an incident EH pair, that is, here's the incident one, that is coming in. Portion of it enters the second medium, portion of it gets reflected. This is the way we are going to be able to satisfy the boundary conditions, and then we'll say, okay, we are happy. Because, what is the methodology once again? The uniqueness of the solutions. Try out something, if it matches Maxwell's equations and the boundary condition, you know it's the right answer, and you move on from there. Okay? So, and what are the Maxwell's equations constraints? Well, in this region and in this region, the constraints are that they obey plane waves. If you're talking about plane waves, they have to obey plane wave constraints. Well, what are those? Well, there is E to H ratio that we know how to calculate as square root of mu over epsilon, the characteristic impedance, and then in each medium, there is an omega-dependent beta if it is a lossless medium, and then if it's a lossy medium, there is an omega-dependent gamma, which is a generalized beta, right? Complex propagation constant. Those are the generalities that we have to obey to, and then at the boundary, we satisfy the boundary conditions with tangential E and tangential H being absolutely continuous, which means that we're going to sum up the tangential E on the region 1. There are two waves in region 1, reflected and the incident. We're going to sum up those electric fields. We're going to get a tangential electric field evaluated at z equal to 0. Make sure that tangential E evaluated at E z equals 0 is same as the E of the transmitted field also calculated at z equals 0. And we're going to insist the same thing with respect to H's. The sum of H's on this side, this tangential component, matches the H that's on that side. That gives us two equations and enables us to solve the reflection and transmission coefficients. Straightforward, but important application, okay? And then later on, in higher level courses, you repeat this sort of thing in more and more complicated situations, oblique incidents and whatnot. Any questions? So now, let us write down all the things that we know are true and allowed by Maxwell's equations. My incident E and H are given by this, okay? With no loss of generality, I select that X pointing, X polarized field. It could have been Y polarized, it doesn't matter. Okay, and also, once you do this for linearly polarized waves, you can superpose them later on to deal with circularly polarized waves, if that's of your interest for you, okay? So I take an X-polarized electric field, there is a corresponding Y-polarized H field, okay? The amplitude of this guy is E0, but there is also a propagator. That propagator is our e to the minus j beta 1. See, I have to distinguish between beta 1 and beta 2 because we have two different regions and therefore different materials. Beta 1 is omega times square root of epsilon 1 times mu 1, okay? And eta 1 is the square root of mu 1 over epsilon 1, and that is showing up in this equation. Any questions? This is straightforward, right? So that's the incident electric field and magnetic field, accompanying field, written in phasor notation. Then we go to the reflected ones, okay? Now, with the reflected ones, it's going to resemble the incident one, but we have to acknowledge certain changes, okay? First of all, the propagators, instead of have minus, they have plus. Why? Because the reflected wave is propagating in the opposite direction, right? So that's one reason. The other thing is, we have introduced an unknown here. It's a gamma, and gamma stands for the reflection coefficient, okay? the amplitude of the reflected wave is not the same as the amplitude of the incident wave. It is different by this factor. Yes, exactly. Wake up. All right? So that's that. And then H, well, you divide this by the same eta. Of course, you also change the unit vector direction to be compatible with the right-hand rule. And instead of plus y-hat, now it is minus y-hat. Okay? So these are stuff that we know. And we have defined by writing these down also something that we are after, that is the reflection coefficient. Any questions?
Okay, so now, let's move on. What about the field in the... Oh, there is one detail I must say here. Okay, just because my incident field was x-polarized, I took the liberty of assuming that my reflected wave is also x-polarized. Some doubting Thomas could have said, perhaps it is going to generate other polarization, etc. I would say perhaps, but let's just try the simplest. Gut feeling, intuition says that same polarization is going to be excited. You can think about the physics of it, right? The physics of it is something like this. If you're an x-polarized wave coming and encountering that wall, some wall, that wall has a lot of charges, bound charges, let us say. Those are going to oscillate in the direction of the electric field, and therefore they will generate a response, also polarized the same way. So this gut feeling tells me, let me not entertain the possibility that x-polarized field is generating a non-x-polarized response, so I assume this, okay? Now, I'm either right or wrong, okay? If I'm right, I'm not going to run in any conflict in matching the boundary conditions, and I will have a solution, and then I will declare that to be the absolutely the right solution because of uniqueness, okay? So that's how we go. And of course, I have seen this before. My teachers taught me exactly the same point. Now you're being taught the same point, and in the future you will think along the same lines too. And perhaps in some very crucial point, you're going to fall into a mistake of because of your some bad habits, and that happens too. Well, sometimes you have to think outside the box. But thinking within the box is also helpful because it makes you get things done fast. Transmitted wave, okay? We continue the same way, okay? If my incident and reflected waves are both x-polarized, I'm also going to assume x-polarized transmitted waves. Otherwise, I cannot meet the boundary conditions anyways. So now I'm in a safer ground, okay? And I write down my transmitted electric field as follows. It is also proportional to E naught, which was the amplitude of the incoming wave field, incident field. But now there is a new coefficient, tau, that's going to stand for transmission coefficient. The other one was reflection coefficient, this is transmission coefficient. And instead of minus j beta 2z, I write minus gamma 2z, just in case the second medium is actually conducting. So I then represent things in alpha plus j beta terms rather than just j beta terms, okay? And finally, I can go and utilize this derived from that to represent the accompanying H. Now this eta 2, if the second medium is a conducting medium, can be a complex one. If it is a complex one, it has magnitude and phase angle. The phase angle will come upstairs and all that. This tau is transmission coefficient. We have used the same letter tau also to declare to as the angle of eta 2. Please do not mix them up. They are, you know, we run out of alphabets, even the Greek ones. We start with Latin, go to Greek. Since we don't know anything else, you're not going to go Hebrew or Arabic or something else. We stick with this, all right? There's going to be some reuse of notation. All right, and tau is our transmission coefficient. And for completeness, eta 2 and gamma 2 are shown for the second medium. They are all in terms of second medium parameters, etc., etc. Any questions? So now the setup is there. Now the solution comes. Tangential E continues at z equals 0. That's fact number one, and fact number two is tangential H is continuous at z equal to 0. All right, so the first one is that tangential component is the x component. The field was only x component anyways. X is tangential to that surface, so I take the sum of incident x component and incident reflected component, reflected x component, add them up, and equate it to the transmitted x component. If we go back and visit all those equations, that gives us nothing than this thing. 1 plus gamma equals tau. Okay, so this was multiplying a whole bunch of things that was also common here and also common there. Ah, one more thing. All those exponential terms go to 0 because I'm evaluating that at z equal to 0. Okay? Right? So that is part of the simplification. I am matching the boundary condition at z equals 0. The exponentials don't matter. What's in front of them matters. And those are E naught for the incident wave. And then for the reflected wave, it is gamma times E naught. And on the other side, it is tau times E naught. E naught cancel out, leaving me with this equation. That's 1 plus gamma is equal to tau. So this is, you should sort of like pay attention to this. This means that the transmission coefficient is 1 bigger than the reflection coefficient. In the future, you will always remember the formula for the reflection coefficient, and then you will automatically get the transmission coefficient by adding simply 1 to it. That's a useful thing to sort of pay attention to. The second, now, that came from the tangential E, is continuous. Tangential H continuous, okay, is sort of interesting in the following sense. When we are dealing with H, there are etas, okay? In medium 1, the incident and the reflected waves have the same etas, okay? And there is also a sign difference between them. The incident one is positive, the other one is negative. Remember minus y hat for the reflected wave? So that is going to account for a sign difference. And here's the full equation. You can see the full equation, right? So this is the h sub y, which is tangential. For the incident and the reflected added together, when we add them together, there is a minus sign coming with the reflected one. And this is the h that is associated with the other side, okay, and different etas. So we cancel out e naughts, and we take eta 1, this is our equation. So we have two equations, two unknowns. Easy to solve. Okay, so I can come and substitute this tau 1 plus gamma, because I know tau is always 1 plus gamma. So then it's an equation only in terms of gamma. When I invert it, I get this equation. It's just one line of algebra. Please do it. It's not very hard. It is also known as bilinear transformation, a term that you will know a little bit more as we go along towards the end of the semester, summer term. Bilinear transformation or Mobius transformation is at the heart of something that is called a Smith chart. And Smith chart is that weird looking graphical aid that we are going to be spending at least a week, the last week of our class. Okay? Anyway, so there is the reflection coefficient. What is memorable here, which is going to repeat over and over and over again, not only in this course, 350 and beyond, the reflection coefficient is an impedance difference divided by the impedance sum. Okay, it is the, learn it once and for all, impedance of what you are banging into minus the impedance of where you are riding divided by the sum. Okay, it's the impedance of the load, so to speak. What you see in front of you is the load minus the impedance of where you are as you are approaching that load divided by the sum. And that 1 plus that is our coefficient of transmission. Any questions? So, these are in general complex, right? Eta 2 could be complex. So these are in general complex, which means that the reflected wave and the transmitted wave have not only an amplitude difference, but some phase difference, which is fine. Don't be alarmed, okay? Now, if the second medium is purely, is lossless, meaning that the second medium is eta is simply square root of mu 2 or epsilon 2, then it is a real number. So then, gamma is going to be a real number, but it can be a positive real number or a negative real number. It just depends whether eta 2 is bigger than eta 1 or not. Again, don't get alarmed if you see something that turns out to be negative. Any questions? Now, if the second medium has a eta that is equal to 0, then the reflection coefficient is minus eta 1 divided by plus eta 1 minus 1. Okay? You have a question?
You're saying imaginary. So if gamma is negative, it's imaginary?
I did not say it right, so let me say it right. Eta 2 can be complex number. Okay. Therefore, gamma is a complex number. Right. And therefore, there's going to be a phase difference. That's all I want to say. Sometimes I make the mistake of saying imaginary in place of complex number. All right? Okay. All right. So that's all. And that is a mistake. That is a mistake. But I think a lot of us are doing that mistake, meaning complex. Complex means that it has, in general, a real part plus an imaginary part. when you say imaginary, you are saying even something more specific.
I was confused by eta 2 minus eta 1, both eta 2 and eta minus eta 1 are real, and then eta 2 is larger, negative, and
Okay, so positive negative is a small business compared to having an angle.
Well, that's what I was confused because
having an angle, you have, you know, 360 degrees of angle to choose from, whereas positive and negative is zero angle and 180. Okay, so so complex number is a generalization that goes beyond the positive and negative, right? We started a species by counting 1, 2, 3. One day somebody invented 0. Someday somebody invented negative numbers. Eventually we invented complex numbers. It's in that progression. Okay? But this gamma, you should think of it as most generally as a complex number. Okay? Sometimes it's going to be, oftentimes it's going to be real in idealizations. But even if it's real, it can be negative. I think we are all in agreement. But eta 2 equal to 0 can come about if you have a perfect PEC. A PEC will make it. Let's go back to our equations. Let's go back to our table. So, I didn't say much about the first and the last rows. The first row is a perfect dielectric. I didn't say much because we were totally familiar with that. That's where we started our business. Okay, then I said the imperfect dielectric, second row, is actually nothing other than the first row except for the existence of a single alpha. The approximations there effectively tell you that the wave is propagating as if it is propagating in a lossless medium, except that it is not lossless. There's going to be a very gradual decrease of the amplitude exponentially. Alpha captures that. There's also a very slight phase angle difference between the E and H. But that is so small that it's sort of like I neglect that. Typically, I disregard this. If I disregard this, okay, then everything is just the same as the perfect dielectric case, except for admitting that there is an alpha. That matters if you propagate long distances. If you propagate short distances, you don't even notice that one. All right, then this good conductor was something extremely new. Okay, it gave us some weird alpha equals beta situation. It told us that if we are communicating in salty sea, we should use very low frequencies, otherwise we are hosed, etc. But now, if we continue with this and take the limit sigma goes to infinity, okay, so I'm interested in this. What happens to this guy? Sigma going to infinity, it makes this term to go to zero. Okay? So perfect conductor, so as you're approaching a perfect conductor, your intrinsic impedance is getting smaller and smaller and going towards zero. So a perfect conductor is a perfect short for these electric waves. And short is zero resistance. So think of it that way. Okay, so then coming back to our current lecture and looking at our reflection and transmission coefficient formulae, we see that if the second medium is a PEC, then eta 2 is going to go away, and that equation is simply minus 1. That minus 1 is reflecting totally from a perfect good mirror. And that was one of the pictures in that movie that we saw. Okay? That was the top movie was a reflection coefficient of minus 1 corresponding to hitting the mirror. If you hit the mirror, if an electromagnetic wave hits the mirror and comes back, it is going to do in such a way that the electric field at the surface of that mirror tangentially is going to be, you guys complete the sentence, Alex. Tangential electric field, so here it is, let's draw a picture. So I have a PEC here, something that doesn't exist, but it is good to think of an idealization useful for many problems, including copper, etc. Okay? You have an electromagnetic wave with an electric field that is coming, propagating towards here. I can draw various pictures. I can draw snapshots, z depending electric field as a function at a given instant, etc. I can do such things. But best thing is to think of that movie, because that movie resolved those problems. It was giving us space and time at the same time. All right? Incident electric field is going to be sitting here
but there is zero electric field here. Therefore, this violates the boundary condition. And how do you get out of the problem? You get out of the problem by saying that the reflected wave has exactly the same electric field but pointing in the opposite direction at every instant at that location. So while this belongs to the incident wave, at the same location, at the same time, there is a corresponding reflected one. And that is why the reflection coefficient is minus 1. That reflection coefficient minus 1 gives you a totally zero electric field at that surface. And what about H? Okay, the H actually does not go to zero, okay? Because the reflection coefficient is minus 1. You remember there was another minus discrepancy between the H of the incident and the reflected. So two minuses make a plus. And therefore, H does not cancel. So you have an H. So what are you going to argue? H is equal to zero inside, but evidently it's not equal to zero. What are you going to... 2H. Huh? 2H. But then how are you going to deal with the boundary condition?
Surface.
Yes, surface charge. This is what you should... Just because you went to this crazy extreme limit, idealization of a PEC, you have to now accept the existence of a surface charge. That's how it comes. In reality, this guy is not a PEC. In reality, there is actually some H inside, there is some E inside, and all that is driving some currents. But all that is conspiring such that because the conductivity is so large that it's happening so close to the surface, you might as well say it's all surface. That's the thing. Okay, there's nothing mysterious. Just like good pragmatic engineering. When you want to make idealizations, go ahead and make them. Any questions?
Okay. So here are the special cases. Region 2 is a perfect conductor, reflection coefficient is minus 1, the corresponding tau is 0. Tau is equal to 0, no field goes inside. So good conductors are good stuff to shield. We build Faraday cages. Sometimes we don't want any interference or electromagnetic waves coming into a certain border because we're going to be making sensitive experiments of some kind. So we then cover the entire building with few inches or centimeters thick of copper, some material like that, and that isolates the interior cavity from the exterior EM sources, although you can never zero out the EM field inside because this copper is also going to radiate because it's going to be at some finite temperature. It will create its own cavity radiation inside, and that is something that we will study in ECE 350. Which is an important idea. Okay, so another special case, region 2 is lossless. Region 2 is the same as region 1, that's the boring one. Eta 2 is equal to eta 1, that gives a reflection coefficient 0, tau equal 1, obvious, you know, then why did we study this? When you go from the first medium to the second medium, nothing changes. Special case number 3. Region 2 is lossless, sigma 2 is equal to 1. Nothing special happens, equations just simplify a little bit. And then you're going to be dealing with purely real valued reflection coefficient, no complex value, and so forth. An example. What do we do in this example? We basically calculate from a given incident field the phases of the reflected and the transmitted fields, after calculating the reflection and transmission coefficients. And then we calculate the corresponding pointing vectors. This is an example like that. Probably there's going to be an example just like that in the homework. Okay? Should we pay some attention? Let's pay some attention to this one. I am going from one dielectric medium to another dielectric medium. I am incident wave is in vacuum, and then the second medium is mu equals mu naught, and epsilon equals 9 over 4 epsilon naught, which is 2.25. This is like glass, okay? Determine the average pointing vectors Si, Sr, St of incident, reflected, and transmitted fields. Okay, my eta 2 is 2/3 of eta naught. Given that, I calculate my reflection coefficient. Load minus propagation divided by the sum. It gives me minus 1/5. Okay? Because this guy is bigger than this guy. I add 1 to it, I get my transmission coefficient, 4/5. Okay. I multiply the incident field with the reflection coefficient and change the flip the sign in the exponent to get my phasor for the reflected wave. From this, I get to H by using the usual tricks. Divide by eta naught, change the direction of E into H so that right-hand rule is obeyed. This negative goes away because two negatives makes it positive. And now I'm ready, E cross H star. One half real part of E cross H star. When I calculate that, I get something negative, see, because the reflected wave is carrying energy in the negative Z direction. The incident wave was carrying it in the positive direction, and the reflected wave is going in the opposite direction. Okay? If the reflection coefficient was unity, or minus one, it doesn't matter, the reflected wave would have the same amplitude as the incident wave, and the pointing flux of the reflected wave would be exactly the same as the incident wave. But when that is not the case, like in this case, what we intuitively expect that the power that is carried by the incident wave, which is sort of like after it meets the boundary, it turns into the reflected wave and the transmitted wave, should that power should equal the sum of the powers that we are going to find associated with the reflected wave. Reflected wave power is going in the negative direction, the transmitted wave is going in the positive direction, they both have some magnitudes. If you add those magnitudes, that should match the incident waves. Pointing flux. Okay, but in order to do that, you have to do all those calculations. Okay, and we do here. Second, for the transmitted wave, we get the pointing flux. We go back to the incident one. We find the incident pointing flux as well, and then we find that they add up. Okay, the incident plus the incident is equal to the reflected plus transmitted. Okay, of course, in this calculation, you take the magnitude of the power pointing flux that is associated with the reflection, because there is a negative sign. Okay, so nothing mysterious there. Energy and power, these are conserved quantities and so forth. So I think I'm done, okay? So tomorrow we do some exciting stuff, okay? We look at, first of all, several concepts, which are radiation pressure is coming in, okay? And after that, tomorrow, probably halfway through, I will start the discussion of transmission phase, which is, of course, the rest of the semester. So don't miss tomorrow's lecture. Tell all your friends who are skipping to come to class tomorrow.